Hello and welcome back. We're live in Philadelphia at Heart and Diabetes. It's an honor to be joined by a longtime friend and a person I had the pleasure of training with, Dr. Taher Modressi. He is a cardiometabolic health specialist from Paddington, New Jersey. And welcome, Taher. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for the invitation to speak to you about something I'm really passionate about.
So the real reason we wanted you to come on this podcast was to share some practical information on implementing the wave of cardiometabolic information that we've seen. You know, this is a remarkable time, I think, across cardiology, across endocrinology, nephrology, and obesity medicine. And some of the biggest challenges we've faced is actually translating that to our own practices. And you've done that in a very fascinating way, and you're one of the pioneers in starting a cardiometabolic clinic. And so I wanted to maybe start by, how did this get launched? What were the initial steps that you took to build a program specifically focused on cardiometabolic health?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's part of it was the evolution of my own career of seeing this need in the space for saying, hey, we have these phenomenal pluripotent therapies, but then how do we actually get these implemented? My initial thoughts and experiences were in the setting of talking to different departments as a general endocrinologist back when I graduated fellowship and seeing there really is a need for integrated care. And if that cannot happen within one institution, potentially setting up my own thing. And so, you know, I went through several other aspects of training on my own and then decided this is something that potentially could work in collaboration with cardiology specifically, because that is an enriched patient population that has a lot of need. And eventually decided, hey, this is something that could work as a standalone clinic, working closely with partners in cardiology, endocrinology, primary care in a community. And that's when, launched a standalone cardiometabolic practice.
I mean, so again, congratulations. We're so happy to have you on the episode today. So in terms of the path, you're an endocrinologist by training,
right?
And the path you took to gain the expertise to do what you do, I think our listeners would really be interested in hearing, you know, how you got there. There's no CKM fellowship per se,
right?
But how did you acquire the skills you needed?
Yeah. And even beyond the fellowship, we actually, in many endocrine programs, and actually probably for a lot of different programs, there's very little exposure to obesity medicine, to lipid-related training. And so this was something that I had an interest in fellowship, but most of it came after fellowship. The ABCL and the ABOM both have separate training paths, non-fellowship-based training paths to become a lipid specialist, as well as obesity medicine specialists. And these are self-training, CME-related, and then board certification test-taking aspects to basically say, hey, this person has engaged with the literature and has come to a point where they have an understanding of what the, you know, approaches are. And those are both processes that I took. And so, you know, I have these board certifications in name, but realistically, the idea is someone who is interested in, you know, this space and these disease paradigms can pursue those independently with the support of these organizations. The National Lipid Association obviously plays a big role in the ABCL pathway in terms of having, you know, annual events and sessions, having, you know, different lipidology courses that do help people, whether they're in training or even after training, who are interested in the disease space, and the same thing with the obesity medicine groups.
Excellent. And maybe before we shift to kind of more of the practical aspects of how you run your practice and how you get patients on therapies, perhaps you can offer, you have a very unique kind of lens. And now looking back, what advice might you be able to share some of, the incoming trainees who are interested in following in your footsteps? And perhaps they're earlier in this path, maybe they're internal medicine residents. What should an internal medicine resident who's graduating today do to become a cardiometabolic health specialist?
That's a great question. So I think, you know, we're all excited about the potential for, you know, fellowships that focus on this field. It's going to be a while before that's actually comes to fruition. And so, you know, you're absolutely right. Ideally, even in my own career journey, I wouldn't have had knowledge and access to these training programs to be able to augment my own, you know, learning environment and fellowship at a much earlier time frame. So the fact of saying, hey, I'm a resident or I'm a fellow and I have an interest in these pathways, well, these organizations offer those training, especially at very discounted rates, which is very important, you know, from training perspective, much earlier. And so I think if you can augment your own learning and education, whatever situation you're in, whether you're in a center that has a lot of resources, and then you can collaborate potentially with people and clinicians at those centers to gain even more exposure, or you may be in a training environment where you don't have access to that and you have to sort of take a few steps on your own to be able to access those kinds of resources, that I think is very important. Two, I would say I found a lot of professional satisfaction being involved in societies and in meetings. And as much as, you know, trainees programs may include support for travel to these, being present in spaces where these discussions are taking place, meeting people, having those ongoing longitudinal relationships has made a big difference in my career. And it's really set me on a path where I feel like I have found my niche and my space. Everyone always has these regrets and say, I wish I would have found that out, you know, several years earlier, you know, without necessarily working as a general endocrinologist for a few years. But I think even that experience exposure led me to find, you know, where I really wanted to be. The only other thing that I would say is that for people who are interested in potentially being in a space outside of academic medicine, being in a practice environment, there is a lot that is missing from our current learning infrastructure about how medicine actually works in real world practice, how do reimbursements occur, and the you know, myriad of issues that come to play when you don't have a billing support staff and other things behind you. And so I think that's been a lot of stuff that I've had to kind of learn on the fly. But there are a lot of online resources and a lot of people that you can talk to, you know, within your own networks, even if it's just your own primary care. Imagine if you're not in, you know, don't see primary care academia, there's people that you really can turn to and just learn a little bit more about the, yes, the business side of medicine, but just the functional side of medicine outside of big systems.
And that's so important. I mean, for so long we've, you know, written about the importance of CKM fellowships or training programs. Mutu's led a lot of that work and the importance of these clinics, but you've actually done that. So it's like really tremendous advice. So now let's get to the meat of what we're all waiting for. You know, if you want to, we have the explosion now of multiple highly evidence-based, highly effective, but also they're branded therapies, right, and trying to get access to our patients with this. So what are your practice patterns and how you do this and how do you think about this?
Yeah, and it's a, you know, it's an everyday thing for my practice. Obviously, I have an enriched cohort of patients who meet criteria, you know, for many of these therapies. Most patients who come in to see me, I don't tell them at the time, but, you know, I can, by guidelines, put them on 4, 5, 6 medications that are branded. And many of these would be, you know, high class recommendations for these therapies. So the first aspect of it is to basically, you know, in my practice, is trying to figure out, you know, who am I thinking about for which therapies? It's a little bit easier for me because these patients are all pretty advanced in terms of metabolic health issues. But two is then the nuances of coverage and cost and affordability and what are they already on, and getting a sense of that from a baseline perspective is really important. What their insurance is, and if you do things enough times, you get a very clear understanding of what things are covered and what the process is for approval. And so while I think, you know, one of the things I really advocate for, especially in smaller settings where people may not have huge resources, is the physicians may need to be more involved in things like prior authorization processes and other processes that historically physicians kind of wanted to sit on a chair and say, I direct therapy, I point to this therapy, and then it just happens. In the current healthcare ecosystems, we can't really do that. We either have to have somebody on the team or the physician themselves do that, at least initially put in that legwork to figure out, you know, what is the pathway. Part of the reason why we've had so much success of implementation in our clinic is because at this point, I know when a patient comes in, I see their insurance card, I know exactly what things are covered, what's on formulary, and what the pathway for approval is. So I'm not going to talk about something if I know that that's not going to be approved. And if I know that I have to go through a separate path to get approval for something, I could start building that foundation early. To me, that is just as important in terms of the implementation of things as is knowing what the right therapy is for somebody.
And that two-step process, I think many of us feel some comfort with that first step of understanding what a patient might need to be on or should be on. For that second step, it's more of a black box. And often after we click various buttons in our EHR systems, it is an unknown of what is next to come. And so many of us are unprepared at that clinic visit of what might that patient's insurance cover. And so for us, it's often a trial period in which we click the button and see what happens, and then try to kind of negotiate the next steps as they come. Is there a centralized resource, or how do you actually figure out? Was this just learned experience from your own from seeing a high volume of patients, or how did you learn each insurance?
Yeah, so it was a little bit of trial and error, and I will give you a few concrete examples. You know, early on when we launched this clinic, I've been doing my own prior authorizations for a while. Again, it sounds strange for physicians to do that. In our system, it's usually uncommon. But I learned very quickly that insurances would cover GLP-1 receptor agonist therapies if a patient had a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, and they accepted all ADA definitions of that, including fasting hyperglycemia above 125, meaning 126 or higher, in addition to A1C criteria. So that allowed me then, when I'm looking at these authorizations, to say, wait a second, there's an opportunity here, because if I can qualify them as having diabetes, by the book, I'm not making anything up. And then if I know that these therapies have cardiovascular risk reduction independent of baseline glycemic control, independent of baseline metformin use, then I can then prescribe first-line GLP-1 receptor agonism therapy to a patient with type 2 diabetes and ASCVD. And once you see that actually works and the insurances do understand this, then it becomes much easier in your future visits to talk about that. Now, a lot of formulary issues have gotten a little bit easier over time in the PCSK9 world, at least in my state and my environment. There's been consolidation around one of the options. So then this issue of like, which one do I prescribe has gotten easier. And I would argue what we've seen in the diabetes space as well as the obesity space and in incretin-based therapies has been the same thing. We, at least again, in New Jersey, in my environment, there is, you know, no particular formulary preference for the absolute majority of plans when it comes to an Ozempic, semaglutide, or tirzepatide, Mounjaro. And the same thing now, and this month mostly, has been the on-the-ground reality for obesity therapies, whether it's Wegovy, which is semaglutide, or Zepbound, which is tirzepatide. So once you start working with these, and you start seeing the pattern of approvals and what the insurance plans actually demand, it becomes much easier in a future visit to sit down with someone and say, oh, I see the card. I already know what the available options are. Congress is also true. We have a plan. It's a big coverage in New Jersey that requires ezetimibe step therapy before PCSK9 monoclonal antibody. So in that situation, if I sit in front of someone, and if it, all my heart, I believe this person should be on PCSK9 therapy, bad secondary disease, low baseline LDL-C, so it's not like, not low, it's still above threshold for intensification, but I don't think ezetimibe, you know, absolute LDL-C is going to make a big difference. And then in the background, I say, hey, this person also has high LPA, and we know that data for PCSK9 inhibitors. I may feel like the PCSK9 monoclonal antibody is the preferred choice and the optimal choice, but if a plan says ezetimibe no matter what, I'm not going to waste time at that visit talking about PCSK9s. I'm going to talk to them, hey, let's do this. We'll check the follow-up LDL-C, and then maybe we can add in the PCSK9 and then de-escalate the ezetimibe. So having a framework when you're talking to patients at the point of care, rather than what you're absolutely right happens in the majority of these visits, which is, I think this is the right therapy for you. Let's see what happens. And then the fall-through rate of patients who don't end up on that therapy is sky high. Part of, you know, what we do in our practice is I get approval before I send the prescription. We are now, you know, facile enough where I can just do the prior authorization while I'm talking to the patient. So most of the time but this is not something that's, you know, out of reach for people. If you do it, it's such an easy system to use that by the time I'm sending the prescription, all those little bumps in the road that oftentimes become big barriers to implementation, which is I sent a prescription, I don't know what happened to it, that I got maybe out of prior authorization, maybe got faxed to a wrong number, the patient never called, all that's gone, right? I send it in, it's already been approved, it gets filled, the patient leaves with a copay card if they have commercial insurance. We'll talk a little bit about Medicare because that's a special patient population where we have other tools to be able to, you know, help those patients. But it's a very different ecosystem when you're talking about a system that's working for the patient as opposed to, you know, I'm going to do what works for me as a physician, and then the patient kind of, if they end up on therapy, great. If not, then they're out of luck.
I mean, what you said really hit home for me because, you know, I'm lucky I have a nurse clinician who helps me,
right.
She splits her responsibilities with me and other physicians. But one of her main jobs for me is not necessarily following up on lab values or people that aren't feeling well,
right,
or anything like that. It's literally what I instruct you. So I start an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist. I say, we need to call in next week to figure out what happened at the pharmacy. Right. Yep. Were they actually able to access that?
Right.
Because what I don't want is I put it in my note, I put it in the EHR, and then I come back for their next visit, you know, however long yep. down the road, and they're like, oh yeah, I was never on that therapy at all. Because patients oftentimes will not necessarily call.
Right.
They won't, I don't know if it's just, you know, uncomfortable talking about this kind of issue.
It is.
So I think your points are so well taken about this.
Yeah. And it's not a benign thing. You know, we have data from the SGLT2 world, we have data from the PCSK9 world, even in the open label extension trials, that there is a cost to delay the implementation. Obviously, you guys know that from the heart failure space, but there's a cost to delaying implementation of these therapies. I haven't seen big data in the GLP-1 world, but I can already assume it's going to be the same. And so I do think that that becomes a really important part of things. Now, whether you have a staff member, my EHR has an actual button I can click to see the pharmacy fills. That's been very helpful to me on future visits. They kind of see, oh, wait, it's like this person's actually getting fills from the pharmacy. But that is a big part of this, is how do you actually not only actually prescribe it, get physicians to understand what the need is, but then actually make sure you close that loop and ensure patients are ending up on it. Cost is a big issue there. And that's something that we work on very, you know, effectively, I think, in our clinic, just to put things into perspective. Again, I don't have a clinical staff, but we have about 90% of our patients with type 2 diabetes and ASCVD on either GLP-1 or SGLT2, about 55% on both, about 80% of those people are on at least GLP-1 monotherapy, and about 90% of people are below threshold for intensification with usually, you know, dual therapy and lipid-lowering therapy, according to the updated expert consensus decision pathway. So this is not just kind of like pie in the sky stuff. This stuff that actually works, but you're absolutely right. You need to have systems that work for physicians and work for patients. It can't just be, oh, we're just going to send a prescription and see what happens.
You do Medicare versus commercial insurance. I want to get into that because I feel like that's such a key issue with my own personal practice of copay cards generally work for commercial insurance, but yet usually not an option for Medicare patients. So unique challenges. So
yeah, absolutely. So there's two very different pathways for these patients. So for people with commercial insurance, they oftentimes have very good coverage. There are people that have big deductibles and there's separate issues there. But copay cards are very effective in lowering those out-of-pocket costs when patients go to the pharmacy. And several of them actually work well, especially if you do 90-day prescriptions. So you basically can get things down to $25 for 3 months. Those, we have them in GLP-1 world, we have them in SGLT-2 world, we have them in PCSK9 world. They bempedoic acid world, they work very well across the board. For people that have still, you know, high deductible plans or need additional help, there are foundations that can help with covering some of these costs. And there are some squirrely things that we can do sometimes from a prescribing perspective. They're technically off label, but that can, you write prescriptions that can, you can use over a longer period of time. So for example, in the diabetes world, there's combo therapies with SGLT2s that are written as twice a day, but if you take them once a day at certain doses, you're approximating doses that you'd get otherwise in monotherapies, and you can use those over 2 months at a time rather than 1 month at a time. So these get completely off label in terms of specific doses, but there are still ways you can get people on therapies that you want them on and help with costs. Medicare is a separate thing completely, just like you're saying. They do not, and copay cards are not able to be used with anything that is through Medicare. And for those, there are really robust patient assistance programs that we take advantage of. These are programs where you have to fill out a form, and the patient fills out the majority of the form along with their financial information. Most of it is income-based, not asset-based. So we've had a lot of people be surprised with just how good of a help it is. And that is, again, GLP-1s, SGLT-2s, and PCSK9 monoclonals. The other big thing that comes up in the PCSK9 world, which a lot of physicians are unaware of, is the use of inclisiran as a buy and bill. That's a separate process. So this is not a pharmacy given drug. It's a healthcare administered drug. So whether you're sending patients to an infusion center to get the subcutaneous injection, or whether you're doing buy and bill in your office, which is what we do, this is something that if someone has Part B and then has, you know, a secondary, Part B is the part that covers 80% of the cost, and then the secondary will cover the rest of the 20%. And so for many patients, they'll have zero out-of-pocket costs, whereas if you give them a Repatha or Praluent, Evolocumab or Alirocumab, send them to the pharmacy, they will oftentimes have big deductibles and big share of that cost because it goes under Part D, which is their pharmacy benefits. So getting familiar with just a little bit of this stuff, which I feel like really is part of the responsibility of physicians is to understand how the system works in addition to how the medications work. That becomes really important. I sit in front of a patient, and if I hear, they're paying a lot for something maybe I don't even prescribe as much. Maybe, they're on low dose of rivaroxaban, and they're paying a lot for it. I already know if I try to write a GLP-1 or SGLT2 or PCSK9 that they're going to have a high cost. So if they're kind of, the financial toxicity question comes to play, and if I know, wait a second, there's other opportunities that I have to be able to implement this therapy, why not take those? Why not start with those as opposed to saying, let me, add to your financial stress. And then if you don't end up on the right therapy by the next visit, then we'll talk about the alternative.
So many pearls of wisdom that you just shared. So thank you. Our time is coming to an end, but I want to end with a few practical tips. So where do we get coupon cards? Where do we get patient assistance program information? And where do we get prior authorizations that can be readily filled out during a clinic visit? So if you could just share that with our listeners, that would actually expedite some of the practical implementation.
Absolutely. So for coupon cards, really, if you Google the drug name with coupon card, it's usually the first link. If you have a sales team that comes to visit your center, they often will bring the hard copy versions, which are also excellent to give because you have information material you can give to the patient. But that is very easy to sign up for. Every company has their own approach in terms of what information they need, but they're usually, something that they print down and they'll take to the pharmacy with them. For patient assistance programs, it's the same thing. If you just search, for example, Ozempic patient assistance program, it'll bring you to the NovoCare website that then has the form that it goes through. Those actually, again, company by company different. Some of them may actually will email it to the clinician, and then the clinician will fill it out, and then they can, their portion of it. There are paper versions as well. You can pre-fill those and have them ready to go when patients come in. So both of those are very Googleable things. Even if someone doesn't have a sales team visiting them, they can just fill that. They can just Google that and have access to it. Prior authorizations, I found that the biggest help to be a website called CoverMyMeds.com. So physicians can and staff can sign up for an account. And that is an electronic system that once you load that patient's insurance, which literally takes less than a minute, once you load that patient's demographics and insurance, it has the form already there. And then it also, importantly, has the clinical criteria as you click through. So you learn very quickly what the insurance plan requires. So if you break it up into two or three major payers, you automatically know when someone comes in, what are the questions that are going to be asked? Is this a PCSK9 monoclonal that's going to just say have a single question that says, do they have ASCVD and their LDLs above 55 and they have SAVA, which is one of our big plans? You already know that's going to be a very easy approval. Or is it going to be a multi-step approval that's going to require a step therapy? That's all on covermymeds.com. I have no affiliation with them, but I use them a lot. And that's something that if you get, as physicians feel more comfortable with, if you load that, if you have that ready to go in the clinic visit, even in between patients, you can fill that very quickly. And then the nice part is that there is a tracking system. So the approvals, denials, appeals, all that goes through that same system. And the need for a paper requisition or a chart has really dramatically decreased. I can't remember the last time I filled out something on paper.
That's amazing information. I mean, congratulations again for all the great work you've done. I mean, you really are the leading edge for how we're actually going to practically implement these therapies today and ensure cost and access is, as little an issue as possible. So just really want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. We want to especially thank our guest, Dr. Tahir Modaresi, for really giving us all the practical tips on, again, things we can do today for implementation and overcoming costs and access issues, some of our highly evidence-based but still branded therapies. So thank you very much for listening. You can find this episode and others on hcplive.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and thanks again.